I wasn't a cherry picker, by the way. I wasn't. Yeah. I like that. You know, what I love about Glenn's reflections is his uncanny ability to, you know, be completely honest about his own inner workings, particularly when it comes to personal generosity and the struggles of daily life. And I think it's true that, you know, last week we talked about what it means to be communally generous, but I want to sort of hone in this morning on what it means to be personally generous. And a confession like Glenn's, I find generosity difficult. In fact, I would say this, I think being generous for me has actually become one of those things that's become tougher as I've gotten older. I don't know if you resonate with that at all, but you know, you can track certain things in life. I actually think I've become more patient over the years. I feel like I've tracked that. But when it comes to generosity, I worry that I'm less generous these days with my time, my money, my energy. I just find it hard to be generous, and especially when it costs me something like my comfort. I was just thinking about this incident this morning. I was asking Kristen about it. It's still haunting my conscience. Kristen and I, we were traveling with Stephen Christie. I don't know if they're here this morning, but you know how tall Steve is, big guy. We were traveling to Africa a number of years ago, and you know, I was a little travel wise by that point. And so when we got on the plane, I asked for the bulkhead section. Got there early, got the bulkhead extra feet room section. And so we did. We got it. It was great. We're sitting there and I could stretch out my legs. And Kristen says, look at Steve and Christy over in the plane. And I look at, you know how tall Steve is. He's like eating his knees. He's just packed up his knees. She's like, I think we should switch seats with them. They look so uncomfortable. I said, not a chance. Not a chance. And I look over at Steve and he's going, hey, how are you guys doing over there? And I'm like, not a chance. And she's like, that's kind of mean. He looks uncomfortable. Let's switch seats. I said, no. If you're not smart enough when you're that tall to get the bulkhead section, you don't deserve it. But I still feel guilty about that. And Chris and I were talking about it this morning. She's like, yeah, that was mean of you. But then I thought to myself, well, if you felt so strongly about it, Kristen, why didn't you offer your seat to Steve? He could have sat with me. But when it comes to situations where generosity actually makes me a bit uncomfortable, I find that hard. And I want to explore that this morning. Why is it that generosity feels so difficult sometimes? I want to talk about three reasons. Still getting over the cough a little. Three reasons why I think that is, and why it's hard to be difficult. Why it's hard to be difficult. It's pretty easy to be difficult. Why it's difficult to be generous, and how I think God's kingdom challenges us and tries to encourage us to flip the script when it comes to generosity. So let's go through these. Let's see how these go. Some of you might get a little awkward. But first one, being generous in a consumeristic culture, I think, is like swimming against a riptide. And maybe this is incredibly obvious to us all, but I want to try to unpack it. I think it's hard to be generous because we live in a culture that makes it virtually impossible to be so. Why? Well, no matter how hard we might fight it, all of us have been shaped by consumerism to one degree or another, and that makes generosity really hard. In fact, Melissa Bowman sent me this week this list of six ways consumerism shapes us. I thought these were telling. Number one, way consumerism shapes us. If I like something, I must have more of it. Second, I expect excellence in whatever I participate in. Third, my unique needs must be met. Fourth, when something's no longer stimulating, I move on. Five, boredom is intolerable. And six, I need new and updated, not old and dated. And here's the crux of the issue in my mind when you think about these. In a consumer culture, we're shaped in such a way as that we come to believe there's no such thing as an end to our needs. And I think this is what makes generosity so difficult. If our needs can never be met, how can we be expected to meet the needs of others in generosity? We're trained and shaped culturally so that it's virtually impossible for us to say, well, I'm done. My needs are done, fully met. I have no needs or wants in life. Now I can concentrate on others. I mean, it's almost impossible. You know, I had a little incident at the mall this week, and had to go there. It doesn't matter why I was there. I had to pick up. I just feel embarrassed every time I go to the mall, so I feel like I need to explain it. But I was there. I wasn't there for shopping, but I was there. And I was walking around and I had an incident where I walked by Sunrise Records and I realized something about myself. I had, going by Sunrise Records, this feeling, this need, which is weird if you think about the history of the music industry. For those of you who grew up, well, even earlier than the 90s, but I'll start there because that's my frame of reference. There was a big need in the music community. We were making mixtapes. And the difficulty with making mixtape, you got to tape the thing and you got to wait by the radio to get a song. Like, in terms of marketing, there's a big need for how we listen to music. And then we evolved to the CD. And you remember those people who had the 5-CD player in the car? They had to open their trunk and load 5 CDs. And that was like the rage. Like, wow, dude, that's awesome. You've got like 60 songs available to you in your car. And it was like there's a need to improve the music market. But when you come to today, this is going to blow some of your minds. I pay Apple $9.99 a month, and I have on my phone access to the entire history of recorded music, the entirety of it, on my little phone. Go ahead, pick a song. You just do, and then you can play it within 20 seconds. It's absolutely mind-blowing to me how easy it is to listen to music. And you would think at this point, we're like, well, we're done. There's no more needs with music. It's accomplished. We're done. We've figured it out. Everybody has all of history's music in one little gadget. But I realized this week, walking by the record store, that I've been shaped to have more needs. And as I went by, I noticed vinyl. And I was just like, my goodness, yes, I have access to millions of songs, but I don't have vinyl. And vinyl people are cool. They like music better than the rest of us. They appreciate it more, and I want to be part of that group. Or, how many of you are on Spotify? You pretentious folks. Yeah, you know it. You know it. Because you're like, Apple? Oh. Spotify is where it's at. I'm like, really? Both services offer you all of music, all of it in its entirety. But for you Spotify people, it's like, well, the curated playlists on Spotify are a bit better. And so now I'm thinking, do I need to get Spotify as well? I don't know what to do, but I had this moment of realization that even though the needs of the music world are met, there's always one more thing. Right? And that's the sort of crux of it to me. This is what living in a consumer culture does. It shapes us to think we're constantly in need of something else. We can literally have it all like we do with Apple Music, and it's still not quite enough. Our consumeristic culture, it creates a scarcity mindset within us. And you know, this moves far beyond just how we think about money or possessions or music. It becomes the posture we see life through. And I think it's a story that life is telling us. This is how Brené Brown describes in her book, Daring Greatly. We get scarcity because we live it. Scarcity is the never enough problem. Scarcity thrives in a culture where everyone is hyper aware of lack. Everything from safety and love to money and resources feels restricted or lacking. We spend inordinate amounts of time calculating how much we have, want, and don't have, and how much everyone else has, needs, and wants. This is a massive challenge for living a life of generosity because we've been shaped to believe we don't have enough. And the things we do have aren't good enough. And so the culture our consumeristic story is telling is that you will never have enough money, you'll never have enough time, enough energy. And when we live into that story, it becomes really hard to be generous. But here's what happens, I believe, when we follow the Christian path, is that I think we're invited from a scarcity mindset story to one of abundance. To move from what I referred to briefly last week, a spirit of poverty, to a spirit of abundance. To be liberated from how our culture trains us to see ourselves as always in need or want of something. And we take this because we take our cue from God, whose image we're created in. And it's interesting, when you get into Jesus' parables, God is pictured as excessively and recklessly generous. God operates out of this sense of abundance. rather than scarcity. And the God that Jesus came to incarnate and reveal is beyond all of our standards when it comes to generosity. And you know, the interesting thing to me is I think the rich today make really easy scapegoats in our culture. And I think we like to believe that the gospel reinforces that. The rich, the 1%. It's interesting to me because in Luke's gospel in particular, it's the gospel that has the hardest on the rich and the wealthy. At the same time, it is also the gospel that makes it most clear that the issue has never been wealth. It's always been an issue of generosity. Christian path is marked by generosity. It's not that riches are bad because God is pictured as excessively rich. What is problematic is hoarding, not sharing. Generosity that God displays is so excessive and scandalous because God operates out of abundance, and we're called to operate as image bearers of God from the same posture God operates from. And so the Christian pastor announces this: riches are good when they're shared. When they're shared. And in Luke's gospel, it's interesting. Jesus praises the generous rich, but is very harsh on the hoarding rich. Parable of the guy who just keeps building bigger barns because he has so much. But when you see God pictured in the Gospels, it's amazing. For instance, consider the parable of the workers. And what's so scandalous about that is people come and they work different times during the day. And at the end, even the people who just worked 1 hour, they get paid as much as the people who worked all day. And the scandal of the story is not like, oh, hey, those earlier guys got ripped off. The scandalous story is this: you can't operate a business that way. You can't be paying people a full day's wage when they've only worked an hour. You can't do that. That doesn't make business sense. But you have this God who's like, but I'm just excessively generous. Or the prodigal son. It's the same thing. I want my money. Okay, have it. Come back, you're still welcomed in. Older son, you know, hey, how come I haven't got any of it? Everything I have is yours. A picture of this just excessively wealthy God who's willing to share. Or the gospel tells a story, the parable of the sower, right? Where the sower God figure goes out and sows seed everywhere, even on the bad ground, the rocks, in the bushes, everywhere. And again, it's this picture of this God who's so wealthy, can afford to simply spread the seed wherever this character wants. It's a God who operates out of abundance. We even see this in the story of the widow's mite, the widow's offering. Jesus is watching people give money to the temple, to the church. People go, they give their money. And this one widow has next to nothing. She gives like a dime. Jesus makes an example of her, right? She gave more, he says. And you see, that's what this God is up to, I think, in the Gospels that Jesus incarnates. This recklessly generous God gives us this perennial invitation. Live by my story. Generosity is tough because we're conditioned to operate from a scarcity mindset. Forever focused on what we don't have, what we're lacking. But God invites us to a different story. A story that starts from a posture of abundance. What does that mean? Well, let's say this. A story that has a start from this posture here. Here's what I have been given in terms of money, time, energy, gifts. How can I be generous with that? As opposed to, what I have been given is not enough. I don't have enough time, enough money, enough energy. That's one way to look at the world. The other is to say, here's what I've been given. How can I be generous with that? It's a totally different mindset. But let's get really human here. Generosity is tough because we have cultural blinders on, keep us thinking we have never enough. But generosity is tough for other reasons as well. And I would say that other reason is this: other people. It's hard to be generous because of other people. Other people aren't carrying their weight, so why should we? It's hard to be generous because of people. You know, there's this passage in 2 Thessalonians that I absolutely love, although it's been maligned and abused. But in this passage, we get a very real look at Paul. And Paul, I know a lot of people aren't big fans of him because he comes across as a jerk, and he's definitely going to sound like that in a moment here. But Paul, we get this very real human look, and he's frustrated here. He's operating in a community, and you can just sense this frustration. And I love it, because I love frustrated people, because I get frustrated, so I love reading about frustrated people. And he's so frustrated here. Listen to what he's saying. Just hear how he's oozing with it. In the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, we command you, brothers and sisters, keep away from every believer who's idle and disruptive and does not live according to the teaching you receive from us. So we get this idea in this epistle, this letter, that there's a bunch of people at Thessalonica who are just doing nothing. It says, you yourselves know how you ought to follow our example. We were not idle when we were with you, nor did we eat anyone's food without paying for it. On the contrary, we work night and day, laboring and toiling, so we would not be a burden to any of you. We did this not because we have no right to such help, but in order to offer ourselves as a model for you to imitate. For even when we are with you, we gave you this rule: the one who is unwilling to work shall not eat. Oh, this is interesting. There's these people, and they're apparently lazy, and Paul's frustrated, and like, this is no good, this doesn't work, so they shouldn't eat. Now, I want to clear up two misconceptions right away here about this passage. First, Paul's writing to a community, a small, local church community that is like pooling their resources together. Let's make it clear, he's not talking about welfare recipients, and he's not talking about socialist assistance. There's no legislative agenda in this text, so let's get that clear. Second, Paul is not saying that people who cannot work for a variety of reasons should not eat. Here's what he's saying. If you're in a community and you do nothing, even though you're capable, if you give nothing of yourself, your time, your money, your energy, your gifts, and beyond that, if you're doing nothing but also creating conflict, and you want your community to cover your meal tab, you can think again. It can't work that way. And to me, Paul is addressing, this is a little awkward, but Paul's addressing, I would say, a challenge that every community faces. It's the 80-20 rule. Some people in community do everything. Other people do nothing. And even worse than nothing, some people create division. And when that happens, what makes generosity so tough is the generous, they feel like stopping being generous. And this is Paul's frustration here. You can hear it. He's like, I'm working night and day to cover myself. I'm trying not to be a burden to anyone. And some of you are intentionally making yourselves a burden. You're doing nothing. You're creating conflict and division, and you want us to pick up your meal tab. He's annoyed, he's frustrated, and his humanity's on full display. And what I love about this passage is what Paul's demonstrating for us is this. It's very easy for our generosity to turn into resentment. And Paul's right on the borderline here, maybe already there. And our generosity can go to resentment, and from resentment it can go to bitterness, which can turn into burnout, which kills generosity. And this happens in communities all the time, not just church communities, any community. Let me give you an example of how this works. And it's not something that's unique to Nexus, so relax. Every church I have a cursory knowledge of has this exact struggle. People volunteering with kids. And this is what happens. It's the exact same story as Paul's. Go, hey, we got a real need here for people to volunteer with kids. And some saint says, hey, I'd love to do that. I'd love to help out with the kids. Awesome. Awesome. And so it starts with a person going, hey, I'm going to be really generous with my time, my energy. And so they start working, and they're there one Sunday. Now they're covering other Sundays. They're there two Sundays, three Sundays. And then they start thinking, does nobody notice that I'm here all the time? And do people tend to think that this is how I want to spend my Sunday morning? Do they not realize that this is actually a sacrifice? And they go, how come these people just keep dropping off their kids and go, and I'm stuck over here? And all of a sudden, a thing that was generous moves to, now I'm getting resentful. And now I'm feeling bitter. And then it goes to, well, now I'm done. I'm burnt out. So, see ya. My generosity was spurned. And generosity is hard because when it goes without being thanked or recognition or other people don't notice or help, what happens? Generosity, resentment, bitterness, burnout. I've seen this happen in neighborhood associations, small groups, groups of friends. I've seen it between neighbors. When everyone isn't pitching in, an act of generosity can move to resentment, bitterness, burnout. And you can hear this in Paul's voice here. He's ready to snap. I'm working the night shift just so I don't have to charge or for food, take food from you guys. And we've got these people over here. They're just sitting around doing nothing. And so he makes a rule. It's a very pragmatic rule. You don't work, you don't eat. You don't contribute to community, you don't benefit from community. And I get it, it sounds harsh, but Paul is dealing with a practical reality here. It's tough to be generous when not everyone is willing to be generous. And his rule seems harsh, but it's how family economies, community economies have to work in order to make it. Now, Kristen's family isn't here, which is good. Because I got to talk a little smack talk about them. I'm the lazy guy there because I don't like the way their system works. Every year we've got three dinners there. We've got the big one where everybody's there. You got Thanksgiving, Christmas, Easter. And I don't like the way it goes at all. Because what they do is lunch is going to be served at 1 and it's turkey, ham, it's everything. It's like a million things we're eating. So the work begins at like 6 a.m. and everybody's doing stuff and cutting up stuff. And so we work for 5 hours. Then finally it's dinner time. And so we sit down. Now, there are 14 grandkids under 8. So you can imagine what a place of peace and serenity that dinner table is. And so it's incredibly chaotic. And so we get about 30 minutes of eating this wonderful meal before somebody's pooped themselves or some kid's crying or, you know, it's chaos. And so we eat for 30 minutes and then everyone's like, okay, well now it's time to do the dishes. And the dishes take 2 hours to clean up these dishes. And in my mind, I'm like, the working to eating ratio is way out of whack here. I don't like it. And so we spend doing the dishes. And then in their family, when you're done doing the dishes, everything's cleaned up. It's dessert time. Then it's dessert time. So then we're going to make a mess again. So we make a mess with the dessert. Then we got to do those dishes. And by the time that's done, it's time for leftover turkey sandwiches. Our whole day is a process of dishes, dishes, a little bit of eating, dishes, dishes, dishes. I can't stand it. And so I thought, I'm out. So I made up a story. I can't believe they bought it. 2 years ago, I won the fishing contest, the summer fishing contest. And I emailed the whole family and said, hey, I won the fishing contest this year, biggest fish, because I'm a good fisher. And I said, as the winner, I am exempt from doing the dishes on Thanksgiving, Christmas, and Easter. And they were like, okay. I was like, this is amazing. They just went along with it. I was like, this is sweet. So there I am. All three family get together, just lounging, having a great time, doing nothing. And then I won the next year, and so I did the same thing. Hey, I won. I don't have to do dishes. And they just let me. For 2 years, I did nothing. Nothing. I showed up. I ate all their good stuff and just lounged around. And I could see the resentment building. And so I lost the fishing competition this year, this summer. And I showed up at Thanksgiving, and I got inside the door, and there was Kristen's sister. She had a knife and a fork. She said, you're carving the turkey. I said, no, I'm not. No, you're carving the turkey. So I carved the turkey. As soon as dinner was done, somebody handed me a tea towel. You're drying dishes. The resentment over 2 years had got to the point, they're like, your time of freeloading, buddy, is done. You are all in here. And you see, I'm the lazy guy in that family, but what ends up happening over time is, right, people start to get resentful. And I'll tell you, there's a me in every community, in every church, in every neighborhood. There's a me, somebody not pulling their weight, driving everyone else nuts. And so Paul does what Kristen's family did. Oh, you're working. You like that stuffing? You like eating? You're working. And here's the thing I'll say this morning. I think some of us need to hear the voice of frustration in Paul. Because he's echoing the voice of frustration that exists in every community. We need to realize in community, be it a neighborhood, a workplace, a home, a church, we need to hear the voice of the frustrated, that their generosity is threatened and made incredibly hard when people feel like they're carrying all the weight. And that's another reason generosity is hard, because eventually some of us feel like we're doing everything. But third, why is generosity so hard? It can be hard to be generous because oftentimes our generosity feels insufficient, flawed, a waste of time. And over time, these things wear on you. They grind you down. They leave you feeling like your efforts at generosity, even if they're modest, that they're useless. I mean, consider how often generosity feels insufficient. Let me ask you this. Have you ever gotten a letter in the mail from World Vision or whatever, even from Nexus, some charitable organization? You know it's coming, right? You know, you pick up the letter, you're like, huh, okay, I've given to them before. You know it's coming. You know you're not going to open the letter and they'll be like, hey, congratulations, we're done. We've got so much money. We don't know what to do with it. So this will be the last you hear from us. We can meet all the needs we need to meet. We're done. No, it's never that. It's right. Hey, thanks for the money. We're still broke. Would you mind sending more money? Right? And over time, it starts to be like, oh. And these days, it's you can't go anywhere. You go into the LCBO to buy a bottle of wine. People are like, hey, you want to give it to sick kids? You're like, I guess so. Go to the pharmacy store, grocery store. Everyone's asking for money all the time. And after a while, it's like, oh, geez. The needs in the world, this is the problem with generosity. As soon as you become generous, your eyes are open to the needs of the world, and it becomes overwhelming really quick, sometimes to the point of paralysis. And more than just feeling like our generosity is not enough, there's some serious issues with being generous in the first place. I don't know if you have felt this at all yourself, but being generous today feels like a minefield. We live in a critique culture, and it feels like every act of generosity we do has some sort of critique to it. It's like, hey, I'm helping people in Africa. There's always that person in the room going, well, if you don't mind reinforcing colonialism, I guess go ahead. You're like, what? Or, hey, I'm going to go serve at the soup kitchen. Well, if you don't mind reinforcing the power dynamics between have and have not. It's like, geez, this is nasty. And people don't give to that organization, too many overhead costs. And the CEO makes more money than you. You want to give to an organization where the CEO makes more than you? I'm like, yeah, maybe. And then there's some people who's like, oh, don't give to that organization. Their model's faulty. It creates dependence. I mean, it's got to the point, this is no joke, little libraries are under attack. Do you know what little libraries are? You've probably seen them popping up. People basically make a birdhouse, stick their books in it, put it on the front lawn and say, go ahead, take my books. It's the most perfect act of generosity. And now there's people like, this is problematic. I'm serious. If you go and Google little library and privilege, there's scholarly articles about how little libraries simply reinforce white privilege and accentuate the difference between have and have nots and take away resources from libraries. And it's like, are you really doing something so simple? I think for a lot of us, it feels like a quagmire. The most simple thing you could do that just seems so pure and generous is like, that's a problem. We got a problem. And when we have problems with every way of being generous, it feels like you almost need a PhD in philanthropy before you can be generous. It's wearisome. Between the never-ending asks and the never-ending flaws, we become immobilized. And it goes beyond money. It's the same with time and energy. I think one of the biggest challenges for Chris and I over the years is how you can spend and invest your life in someone or give certain people time and have that go nowhere and you feel like it's a waste. But here's the thing. No matter how much we feel we're insignificant or our generosity doesn't do much or it's flawed or we're wasting our time, the Christian path asks us to reframe the way we see generosity. Because what the Christian path insists is this. In God's economy of giving, there's no waste. None. No time or energy or money or investment is a loss or worthless. In God's economy, it doesn't work that way. I love this story. It's one of my favorite stories from Jesus. Matthew 26, it's in all four Gospels. It's he's being anointed by this woman. And I love the lines here. Take a listen to this story, Matthew 26. While Jesus was in Bethany in the home of Simon the leper, a woman came to him with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume, which she poured on his head as he was reclining at the table. When the disciples saw this, they were indignant. Listen to their words. "Why this waste?" they asked. "This perfume could have been sold at a high price, the money given to the poor." Aware of this, Jesus said to them, "Why are you bothering this woman? She has done a beautiful thing to me." And I love this story because I think it completely upends our economies of giving. It teaches us something extraordinary about God's economy of giving. In our economies, we measure our giving and generosity by its effectiveness. How many people notice? How many people are enriched by your generosity? But in God's economy, beautiful counts. Beauty counts. Our generosity is measured not by effectiveness, but by beauty. And I love how Jesus frames this in terms of her accusers. They're like, "What a waste. What a waste. We could have done so much with that money. Clearly she doesn't know how things go. This is such a waste." And Jesus is basically like, "Sure, but it was beautiful. But it was beautiful. And that counts." And you know, if what you do is beautiful, it counts. You know that money that you gave here to some other organization, and it felt like a huge deal to you because you didn't have much to give and it made that month really, really tight, but you gave anyway and it felt like no one noticed. And you felt like you made that sacrifice and it didn't make any difference at all. We often feel that way, but you know what? It was a beautiful thing. And that counts in God's economy. Or that time you invested in some sort of volunteer work and no one noticed and no one stopped to say thank you. No one seemed to care. Feels like it was a waste. But in God's economy, it's like, yeah, but that was beautiful. And that counts. Or that energy you poured into that relationship, you gave that person wisdom, you gave them emotional resources, only to see that relationship fall apart or abandon. It feels like it was a waste, but it was beautiful. And in God's economy, beauty counts. In God's economy, generosity of any kind, flawed or insignificant, is beautiful. And in God's economy, success is measured by beauty. And so we have this widow, right, who gives a small amount out of her actual scarcity. And her dime that she put into the temple offering, it probably did nothing for the temple building fund. But it was an act that was beautiful. And Jesus says, that's what my economy of giving is about. And the woman decides to put that expensive oil on Jesus' head. And everyone in the room thinks she's stupid and excessive and wasteful. And Jesus says, sure, but it was beautiful. And that counts with me. Or the boss who decides to pay his people who worked only an hour, he pays them a full day's wage, and everyone thinks that's silly. You're going to go out of business in no time if you're acting that way with your money. And Jesus is like, okay, but it's beautiful. And beauty matters, whether people recognize it or not. I like how Paul encourages us in 1 Corinthians 15. He reminds us to keep on being generous, to keep on doing good, because in God's economy, there's no waste. Paul says this, "Therefore, my dear brothers and sisters, stand firm. Let nothing move you. Always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain." There's this mysterious notion within the Christian path that God is going to take all of our efforts, flawed, insignificant, and make them and turn them into something beautiful in a redeemed heaven and earth. And you know, the truth is, it's so hard to be generous with our time, our money, our energy. It so often feels insignificant. It feels insufficient. It feels like a waste. It feels like a drop in the bucket. It's not worth it. But in God's kingdom economy, Paul tells us our efforts, our work is not in vain. It matters. Even if no one notices, even if you're never thanked, even if it is flawed. And so my hope this morning would be this, that we would leave here hyper aware, but not of our lack, but of our abundance. And even though some of us tangibly have very, very little, that we would learn to reframe the way we see things and say, I have been given this. How can I be generous with that? My hope is that we would leave here this morning understanding that the economy of generosity in church is the same as doing family dishes. It's a whole lot more fun when everyone's on board. My hope is we would leave here this morning confident that while our generosity may be flawed, it might go unnoticed, that we would understand all the work we give, the money we give, the energy we pour into people, the time and our talents that we give as an act of generosity, that's beautiful, and God counts beauty. In God's economy, nothing's wasted. And so may the knowledge of that move us all, I hope, to be more generous. We are out of time, so we're going to close. I'm going to do a quick prayer to close. But I also want to tell you about next week. Next week, you have seen our guild in action here when they had a whole bunch of them. We've got our first full-length sermon guild next week, and I'm very excited about it. Erica is going to be sharing with us, and we put our guild through a rigorous process. It's not easy. They have to stand up and give their talk in front of a small handful of people and then receive criticism, feedback, that they have to then go and make some changes and improve and then come and present here. So it's not an easy process. And I just want to fill you in. That's what's happening. And so when you see Erica here next week, it's not just, hey, here's what I have to offer you. It's something that's been honed and we've been working on. So I hope you will join us for that. It's going to be exciting. And I know she's got an interesting word to give us on mirrors. So that will be good. But as we go this morning, may we pray that God's spirit will work through us to melt our hearts, allow us to be more generous. So let's pray as we go. God, thank you for the stories of the Gospels, which show us just how exceedingly generous you are. And may we never take that for granted. May we always know how abundant your grace is. And when we're tempted to think of you as a frugal or cheap God, may you dispel that notion in us that you are exceedingly gracious and generous with us. May that move us and remind us that we can operate from that posture as well. So God, make us the kind of people you want us to be. Allow us to be people who are generous, even if we have little, that we would be able to see what we have as a gift from you and be generous with that. And so we thank you for that and ask your blessing on the rest of this day. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Go in peace.